Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And it's so good to have you back with us again as we explore the exciting business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. In the first half hour, we're going to talk about nuclear power because Nick Turan of TerraPower has a remarkable new nuclear reactor like it's never been done before. And this is totally new stuff. You are absolutely going to love it. And as we get into it a little bit, we're going to see that this could very well be the solution of the United States' problems with Iran. And in the second half hour, we're going to have Meyer Sassoon. He is chairman, and the fact is the second-year chairman now, of the IEEE Energy Policy Committee. And he is going to tell us about the recommendations that the IEEE Energy Policy Committee is going to be making to industry and to government. And, of course, you know IEEE is having a very significant green technology conference in Baton Rouge, the 14th and 15th of April, coming up here in a little bit. And if you want to know more about that, go to our website and you will find a link, promiseoftomorrow.biz, the right-hand side of the screen. And, of course, we're going to visit the Den of Strangers, visit our fountain of useless information that in the second half of the program, of course, at the end of the show, listener comments and the voice of reason. And right now, though, let's dial up today's guest and let's get into this nuclear power thing because I think you are absolutely going to love this. Okay, last week we talked about coal. And this week we want to talk about nuclear again because it seems like the nuclear people and the coal people are kind of on opposite ends. We're fortunate today we have with us a reactor physicist by the name of Nick Turan. He's with TerraPower. And TerraPower is a little bit different type of nuclear reactor, and we're gonna get into some pretty fascinating stuff. Welcome to the program, Nick.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Now, this nuclear reactor that TerraPower is pioneering. Can you give us some background on that and how it came? What is it? How did it come about? And give us a good feel for what we're talking about here with a nuclear reactor.
Okay, well, so TerraPower is developing something that we call the traveling wave reactor, which, like most nuclear reactors, splits atoms, such as uranium atoms, and releases a huge amount of energy, which you then turn into electricity somehow.
Okay.
And so the difference in the traveling wave reactor and conventional reactors is that this thing, eventually, once you get it started, can run just given natural or depleted uranium. You don't have to do any of this enrichment stuff that you have to do with standard reactors. And that gives a lot of benefits that we can discuss later on. But first, how it came about. People have kind of known that this may be possible all along from the early days in nuclear development, but there were a lot of challenges that kept it from really being something that they thought would work right then. But as time has gone on and technology and computer models have advanced, we've come back and we're taking another look at it, and it looks to be very possible, and we're developing it so that we can get the benefits that it can provide.
Okay, now what you're saying, and this isn't a breeder reactor, but that's the first thing that comes to mind to those of us who know very little about nuclear energy. What you're actually doing is you're taking what would be considered nuclear waste and getting power out of it. Is that correct?
That's correct. Well, what we're mostly talking about is using sort of a low-level nuclear waste, which is depleted uranium. It's not the very radioactive stuff that comes out of regular reactors, although we can use that as fuel as well. But what we're really interested in is just using the depleted uranium left over from the enrichment process, which is just a big pile of stuff that has no use. We can turn that into, you know, years worth of United States energy or anywhere energy. Just huge amounts of energy come out of that thing that is waste, we can turn it into energy.
Okay, well, the world's big reactors generate about 1,500 megawatts of electricity, I understand, and that powers about a million and a half households. But your reactors are designed to work on a smaller scale, I understand, or am I wrong there?
Well, we have a variety of different sizes. This is not actually a small modular reactor, which is something that a lot of the industry is becoming interested in. There's a inherent minimum size for this reactor because of the way it needs to, you know, keep track of all its neutrons. You can't make it too small or else too many of them leak out the sides. And so the small version that we're looking at is going to produce something like 500 megawatts of electricity, which isn't, you know, it's not one of the very small ones that you may hear about, but it's also smaller than what you mentioned. But we also have designs which are large, you know, on the scale of the conventional reactors that you mentioned.
So the ones that we're talking about right now would do what? Power a city or a state or a number of cities, or what is this designed to do?
Yeah, let's see, 500 megawatts electric would power a medium-sized city. So it's not something you'd put on in a remote village in Alaska or, you know, on a military base or something. This would be for, you know, a bigger area than that. But that's just the first one that we're looking at building. The final ones may be the big ones that would power full large cities, you know, 3 gigawatts thermal. So, you know, big reactors.
Don't you need a serious water source for these things? I mean, it isn't like something just any city could go ahead and put in without really having a serious water source nearby, would there?
Yeah, that's right. You need like a river or a lake at least. You do need some serious water to carry off the heat that's being produced. One advantage of this reactor that we're making is that it's about 10% more efficient than standard reactors, so you would need less water for the same amount of energy with our reactor than you would with a conventional reactor, but you still do need a substantial source of water. That's correct.
Well, now, without making our eyes glaze over here with too much technical stuff, how do you manage to become more efficient than a regular nuclear reactor, the type that we've seen for the past 30, 40 years or so?
Well, there's two types of efficiency that we can talk about. The one that I was just referring to is just thermal efficiency, which means if you make so much heat, how much of that can you convert to electricity? And the reason we're able to get more electricity out of the same amount of heat is just that we can operate at a higher temperature. And the rules of thermodynamics say that if you can run at a higher temperature, you can be more efficient. And the reason we're able to run at a higher temperature is that we're using a different coolant and a different type of fuel than conventional reactors that allows us to operate at a higher temperature. The second type of efficiency, which goes back to the fuel utilization I was talking about earlier, is how much energy you can get out of a certain amount of fuel. And so conventional reactors take 1% of the energy out of uranium, and this reactor can take up to 30%. So you're getting a factor of 30 more energy out of the resource. So those are the two big efficiency improvements that we're making.
All right. Well, nuclear waste, I understand, from these nuclear plants that are currently in operation, are being stored right on the site. And would you then transport nuclear waste from other nuclear sites over to, say, your site to feed the reactor that you're talking about?
That is a possibility. We're not looking at that very hard because that would require that you do some chemical separations.
Really?
And so you'd have to take that waste from a conventional reactor and stick it into this chemical plant that would separate it into its various constituents, and then you would refabricate new fuel that could go into our reactor without having to go back to the mine. But one of the big advantages of our reactor is that you can get the really high sustainability that you can from other advanced reactors, but you can do it without needing a reprocessing plant at all. And that's one of the really big advantages of the traveling wave reactor. And so, while you could do what you mentioned, you may not want to if you're trying to eliminate these reprocessing plants from your society.
Okay, reprocessing plants. Where does a reprocessing plant fit in the scheme of things with a nuclear reactor? I have to ask the dumb question because, as I tell everybody with this program, all the listeners and the guests are all smarter than I am. So I've got to really ask the stupid question. Where does a reprocessing plant fit in, Nick?
Sure. Okay. Well, a reprocessing plant is something that we have built before, and the French and the Japanese and some other people are operating reprocessing plants as we speak, but the United States has chosen to not operate reprocessing plants for its commercial industry. And what a reprocessing plant allows you to do is recycle your nuclear fuel. So when it comes out of the reactor, you stick it in the reprocessing plant, you take the fission products out, which are what uranium becomes after it splits, and then you can make that into new fuel and stick it right back in your reactor. And you can do that a number of times.
Okay.
And that's great. That really allows you to get sustainable amounts of energy out of uranium. But there's some problems with it. And some of those are, first of all, it's very expensive. When this nuclear waste goes into that reprocessing plant, you have to do all your handling of it remotely. So you have to use robots, and it has to be behind these large shielded glass slabs, and it just is very difficult to handle. Another problem is when you're separating out everything and you have one pile of the fission products, one pile of the uranium, you also get a big pile of basically pure plutonium, which conceivably could be stolen by somebody, and that would put them one step closer to having nuclear weapons material. And so the United States chose to not pursue reprocessing, mostly for the weapons problem, because you just don't want that kind of material laying around in that form because of the weapons risk. And so, and there's a debate going on. You know, a lot of people say, oh, reprocessing plants, no problem. But the traveling wave reactor allows you to get the benefits of having a reprocessing plant, which are high sustainability, low amounts of waste, stuff like that. But we do it without needing a reprocessing plant at all.
So the waste then with your process, with your traveling wave process, would actually then have no waste or have very little waste or pretty harmless waste? Or what are we talking about? And then and what are you going to do with that waste? Where would it go?
Yeah, well, it still is, you know, dangerous waste, and it's still the thing that we do better is that we have less of it, about up to six times or maybe a little bit more less of the waste. It's still, you know, it's still high level nuclear waste, and so rather than in a reprocessing or a closed fuel cycle, rather than sticking it into a reprocessing plant and doing all that with it, this would just go straight into long term repository, where, you know, it would be put in a geologic store where it can be, you know, where it stays out of the biosphere for as long as it takes before it decays to stability.
So you wouldn't store it on site then? Is that what you're saying? You'd move it over to some other place from the where your plants are?
Well, it would basically follow whatever plan the current nuclear generation has and wherever this thing gets built. So, first of all, it'll sit in the reactor for about 40 years. It doesn't have to leave the reactor, so it'll be just inside the reactor. And then after that, it's going to go into whatever the current waste management plan is. And that may include some reprocessing, or it may just include a long-term geologic repository. And in that case, it would just get shipped off to wherever that repository is, and it would sit there for however many years it takes to decay to being harmless.
Well, we all know that Yucca Mountain is dead, or at least it appears to be for the time being. It doesn't look like it's coming back anytime soon. So where then, if it wasn't stored on site, where would it be stored? Because right now I understand that all the stuff is being stored on site for these nuclear plants.
That's right. So, I mean, if we had a traveling wave reactor right now that was discharging spent fuel, it would sit on site just like light water reactor fuel does now. That's right. And so, you know, it's basically going to have the same fate as what we have right now for the nuclear waste. There will just be less of it.
Well, like, for instance, if the city of I'm in Dallas, if the city of Dallas had its own nuclear reactor that of one of your traveling wave reactors, do you think then that you would have to overcome some pushback from the public of having a nuclear reactor in waste so close to the city? Because right now the closest nuclear reactor we have here, I think, is Comanche Peak. But how would you overcome that?
Well, I think just sort of people are inherently afraid of nuclear things because radiation itself is just kind of a scary thing. You can't see it, you can't smell it, but it could be there, you know, hurting you somehow. And so I think one of the best ways to manage that kind of, and there will, of course, be people who, you know, will protest against that kind of thing.
Sure.
And so I think a good approach would be to sort of just educate people on, you know, what nuclear waste is, what its dangers are, and, you know, how it's contained on site and what these canisters are like. I mean, they have videos of on YouTube of these canisters getting, you know, driven, put on a rocket-powered truck and driven into a brick wall at 90 miles an hour and then dropped onto a spike and then burned in jet fuel for 90 minutes and, you know, they don't leak at all. They have these very impressive canisters, mm-hmm. and there's no safety, there's no, like, event that has happened with nuclear waste that has caused harm to the environment. And so I think if you can just sort of convey that message to the public, then they will be more accepting of the technology, especially considering the alternatives, which could have much worse consequences than these very small amount of contained nuclear waste.
Like what sort of alternatives that would be more dangerous? What illustrate that for us?
Well, I mean, so if you're afraid of radiation, for instance, it turns out that a coal plant releases about 200 times more radiation than a nuclear plant does.
That's
just
really?
A standard nuclear plant.
Whoa.
So there's uranium and thorium in the dirt all around, you know, the whole crust of the earth. And when you take coal, which has some of that in it, and burn it, and then release it into the atmosphere, just the naturally radioactive things that are floating around in there, when you inhale them, you get 200 times more radioactive dose than you would get by living on the gate of a nuclear power plant, for instance. So that's just the radiation damage. And then there are, of course, all the consequences of the particulates and acid rain and CO2 mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And so basically the environmental footprint of the nuclear reactor is just, you know, very, very low compared to these other baseload sources.
Well, I understand the waste is often being stored in glass tubes and everything else, too, so that they can't leach anywhere. But Ed Morse, who is a nuclear scientist at Caltech, has been on this program on a couple of occasions. He believes, and I'd like to get your opinion on this, he believes that fusion is going to be the dominant form of energy within his lifetime, and that I would presume he's talking about the next 20 years. Are you guys set up for that, or is it all fission with you? And how do you what do you think of fusion?
Well, this is a this effort is all based on fission, so there isn't like a transition to fusion with the traveling wave reactor. There's no like real analogy there.
Okay.
Our CEO here used to be one of the head honchos for the fusion project ITER, and that's supposed to be the first fusion device that achieves break even, where it produces more energy than you have to put into it.
Mm-hmm.
And that project, as far as I can tell, has become, you know, it's using this incredible technology that is, you know, extremely challenging, and they're having lots of trouble with it, and it uses, you know, some fraction of all the heavy metals in the earth to make the magnets and stuff like that. It's not really in a form that seems to be deployable on like a worldwide scale, even if they can get it to work. I mean, we have some technological challenges to overcome with the traveling wave reactor, but the fusion people have, you know, many more technological challenges to overcome. And so I would like fusion to work at some point because it has potential to be a great energy source, but right now there isn't really a feasible, like, short-term path that I can see that's going to, going to happen. I actually started out wanting to study fusion. When I got into this field, I was like, fusion, oh, really? That's everything. And then the more I kind of learned about it and saw how the progress was, it looked to me that fission is really going to be the thing that's going to give us sustainable energy in a responsible way. I don't think fusion won't happen, but I just think it's going to take a lot more work than what we... It's going to take a lot more time than what we really have to give, is my opinion.
Well, Nick, you mentioned your CEO. I think you're talking about John Gilliland. Is that who we're talking about?
That's right, yeah, John Gilliland.
And he was a fusion scientist at one time. I had no idea. Well, I've talked to some people at MIT who are doing the fusion, and they admit, and what you just said, that it takes as much energy to put in to do fusion as it does to get any energy out of it. And so they don't think that's the way it's going to go. But I understand, and correct me here too, that there are about 30 applications for nuclear power permits to be built in the United States in the next 10 years or so. Is that some of the projects you guys are working on, or are you over and above that?
Those are all actually just more conventional light water cooled reactors. None of those are such advanced reactors as the traveling wave reactor. So those are all just kind of, they're not exactly like the ones that we have today, but they're, a step, just a sort of a smaller step change from those. So we are not one of those, actually.
Well, I know you're pretty revolutionary, but you haven't been around a whole long time, have you? How long has TerraPower been in business developing these things?
Well, TerraPower was sort of conceived in this brainstorming session in just 2006, so it's very new. And since then, we've been recruiting a lot of different people, and we've expanded rapidly, and, we've started, really producing a lot of conceptual design work and stuff like that. And so for its very short life, we've gotten a lot done, but it is a very short project. But the traveling wave reactor as a concept has existed, so there's been some papers and some studies of it over the last couple decades. This is just really the first time anyone's tried to make an engineering embodiment of it and really develop it and deploy it.
So do you have any deployed right at the moment? And if you do, who are your customers?
Well, no, we don't have any deployed right now. We're in discussions with various institutions across the globe as to who, wants to build a prototypical one or a demonstration one that kind of shows that it can be done, because there are some challenges that we need to prove materials can be in a reactor for as long as we need them to be in there. And so we can't just start building a whole fleet of them right now. We have to sort of build one and see if it works. And then if it does, which we have a lot of reason to believe it will, then we expect everyone to be a customer.
All right. Well, can you tell me how soon one of these might come to fruition and who could be a likely customer, or is that still pretty top secret stuff?
Well, I can tell you when. Who exactly we're kind of keeping, close to our chest, but, just because it's sort of sensitive. But the schedule right now is that we'd like to have one operating by 2020, which, is 9 years from now.
Yeah, right.
And that's basically light speed in the nuclear world. So that's a very rapid deployment plan for us.
Yeah, I understand. 10 years is pretty normal for developing a new reactor because of all the regulations that you have to go through. It could be developed faster than that, I'm told, if there wasn't so many safeguards and regulations. But that's because the United States apparently is pretty touchy about how a nuclear reactor is made. So you think 2020, and you can't tell me who it's going to be, but when you finally can, you're going to let me break the story right here on the Science News Radio Network. Is that right?
Sure. I'll give you a call.
All right, I'm going to hold you to that, Nick. You know that, don't you?
Okay. I will write it down.
And with that, it's time for the break. But when we come back in the second half hour, there is one significant prospective client that Nick does tell us about, Iran. So join us in the second half hour right after these words. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
Oh, yes, through the cobwebs here. Father Theodore Herzberg of Notre Dame. The very essence of leadership is to have a vision. You can't blow an uncertain trumpet.